Welcome to First Reading, the Old Testament Lectionary Podcast for everyone who loves the Bible in the world. My name is Paul Essen. I am a PhD student in Hebrew Bible, Old Testament Studies at Yale University.
And I'm Reverend Dr. Rachel Wren, Assistant Professor of Biblical Studies at Trinity Lutheran Seminary at Capital University. Tim and Rosie are off this week, and guess what? We have Prophet Isaiah again today. This is one of those seasons it feels like where we're in Isaiah a lot. It's Isaiah's call narrative in Isaiah 6, 1 through 8, with the option to include verses 9 through 13. So, Paul, where is your heart at today?
I'm not a big liturgy pressing, but I kept thinking about how this passage, with all of its otherworldly imagery, especially like thrones and like, you know, voices and angelic figures and stuff like that, how they all fit very well into some of the liturgical moment here. And I'm thinking here specifically Epiphany, which we just got out of, and then Transfiguration, which I think we just entered or about to enter. But before I get ahead of myself, let's do some brief context, because Isaiah is like dense, you know? So as we have said many times on this podcast already, Isaiah is traditionally divided into three major sections. First Isaiah is chapters 1 through 39. Second Isaiah is chapters 40 through 55. And third Isaiah is 56 through 66. Here we are in First Isaiah, right? So First Isaiah is often associated with the historical prophet Isaiah of Jerusalem, which dates somewhere around the 8th century, same time period as Micah or Hosea or Amos, any of those. It is a period of political upheaval with the rise of Assyrian powers and threats, threats to Judah's sovereignty. And the entire troupe shifts between judgment and hope, addressing issues such as social justice or social injustice, idolatry, apostasy or trusting in foreign alliances and things like that. And I think this is usually where some of my friends would ask me, like, what's going on with all these like changes in language? Because at some point you hear a lot of judgment, and at some point you hear a lot of hope. And I think it reflects some of the the cultural nuance as well. Isaiah 6 specifically, which we have here, is set in the year that King Uzziah died, right? And that's somewhere around 742 BCE. That's my estimate. And this was also a transitional moment for Judah, because Uzziah's reign had been, you know, very long and relatively stable. And, you know, as a serious threat during this moment likely heightened that anxiety about Judah's future. So some of what Isaiah is called to do is to name some of the occurrences of the time and to bring God's, you know, perspective on some of the issues of the time. And as we can tell, this passage is Isaiah's commissioning. This is when Isaiah is actually called to do the work of a prophet. The moment where he's, you know, basically ordained, as we can think of it in contemporary times. And this is a very popular passage, but it does have a lot of historical reference and relevance. And I'm sure that's why the RCL kind of brings it up almost every year.
Yeah, no, I think that's really helpful context. Like, even if I feel like you can't say often enough the fact that there's three Isaiahs and the different historical contexts that they come from, because it's just so easy to get those mixed up or lost, especially when you have a passage like this that's just filled with otherworldly imagery that you were kind of talking about. It's really helpful too to think about this in terms of both call and ordination. I mean, I think those like framing, we use those words today. So that's a really helpful way to understand what's going on here in and through the midst of these giant robes and these winged seraphs and all this other stuff going on. So So what else kind of strikes you about this passage? Where would you take preachers?
Yeah, you know, verses 5 and 6, Isaiah's response to the call. It says, "Woe is me, I am lost, for I am a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips. Yet my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts." That's really striking. Like the language of unclean lips. It's like the sudden self-awareness and realization of both his whole awesomeness that he has experienced, but also that in comparison to himself and his own limitations and flaws, his abilities, inabilities, and worthiness and unworthiness, all of that at the same time. And I think that it is relatively common for people to experience a divine presence or an otherworldly experience or a holy moment, and then immediately think of themselves. You know, we can think of Exodus 19, the Sinai Horeb theophany, when the people had just come out of Egypt, and God said, I'm going to talk to these people today. And then God came out down the mountain and revealed himself, and the people were like, dude, we're not going to do this anymore. Next time, please go talk to God yourself and come report to us. This one-on-one thing doesn't work. It's too scary.
That's amazing. Dude.
And Moses too, like when he's called, is called by God in Egypt, his first response is, I cannot speak. I don't have a mouth to speak, right? Jeremiah also does the same thing. It's like, God, where's my mouth to speak? Again, my point is, it is not uncommon for one to reflect on their own disqualification in the presence of such glory, right? And some have commented on Isaiah's response as humility, and that his declaration of woe is me is like humility or some kind of a humble sin confession moment. But, you know, I don't really think I agree. I see God's presence magnifying his life. And in that relationship, he's definitely awestruck. And I think his expression of woe is part of that feeling of reverence and awe. I'm not necessarily reading that as part of like a sin confession or a humility or whatever, you know?
I think so too. And I think your use of Exodus 19 as an analogy for this is just perfect. Because I think when it's an individual saying, woe is me, we go straight to like individual sin, especially in the United States, because we are so individualistic. But obviously in Exodus 19, they're just like scared out of their minds. They're just terrified, like you said so beautifully, in the presence of such glory. So I think that's definitely a great way to go with it. I suppose like the unclean lips part does seem to lend itself to an idea of sin. So what do you do with the unclean lips?
Yeah, I kept thinking about that. And I think that is definitely illuminated by what he is called to do, right? So in verse 9, he is called to go and say. Right? It's a ministry involving the mouth. It's a ministry involving words. And in the moment, he's realizing that his speech is limited and his voice reaches only that far. His ability to carry out this mission is sort of marred. And that's the language of uncleanness, at least in my reading, right? The other one is the live coal on tongues moment in verse 6. So remember in verse 6, there's this live coal that this angelic figure picks up with the tongue and then, you know, places on Isaiah's mouth, and then Isaiah's, you know, mouth is purified, right? Cleaned. And I don't have much to say about that except to say that the live coal heals him from his speech limitation that I am alluding to here. And no doubt that all of this is happening in some kind of an alternative space, alternate otherworldly space. So it isn't literal fire burning Isaiah's mouth. And I would also say too that although Isaiah utilizes the language of unworthiness, he doesn't stay there too long. You know, he moves on from my lips are unclean in verse 5 to here I am, send me in verse 8, which I think is a bold act of surrender and readiness. So I essentially just read all of that as part of this like grand awestruck moment, you know, recognition of my own limitation. I need to be readied. And then that is also highlighted in verse 8 where like, I am ready. You know, I'm going to do this. I'm ready, God. Let's do this now.
Mm-hmm. This is kind of Isaiah's let's go moment, if you're the phrase of today. Yeah, no, super helpful. Super helpful. Do you have any other tips that preachers should keep in mind as they kind of approach this text?
I'd say, like, in terms of preaching, because this passage is so common every year, it basically shows up. I'm sure preachers may have, especially preachers who've been preaching past 1 year, 2 years, they may have said a few things about the passage already, like, you know, the language of call and being commissioned and being sent out, being a prophet, you know, and the significance of being a prophet and standing in place of God in a very historic moment as this, you know, I think all of that are very powerful moments. But definitely leaning into the liturgical moment also is important here, which is one of the things that I want to highlight, which is explore how Isaiah's experience of God's presence and a revealing of his call could resonate, you know, the Epiphany, which we it's just passed, and Transfiguration, which is just coming or it's here already. And if possible, I'll also say maybe don't skip verses 9 through 13 without at least acknowledging their complexity. And this is a tough commission, essentially telling Isaiah to preach a message that won't be received, right? And if I were preaching this passage, I would read all of that as a reminder that faithfulness in ministry isn't always about like the tangible results. It's also reflected in the very act of going, whether there is actual results that can be measured or not. Because if you read all through 9 to 13, it's basically saying like, you know, their ears will not hear, their hearts will still be hardened, and all the difficult things that none of us would like to hear at the beginning of our ministry before the ministry actually starts.
Right.
You know? But I think the faithfulness here, if that language is appropriate, is in the going, is in Isaiah saying, God, I am ready, I'm going to do this, you sent me, and here is it, right? I would also add one pitfall, which is in context where, you know, there's belief in like physical enemies or spiritual enemies or enemies of progress, where people hold on to the ideas that like their progress or their life's progress, their individual life's progress are hindered by living or spiritual enemies. They read verse 1, the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord as like Uzziah's death allowed Isaiah to see and experience this glory moment, right? Which without Uzziah dying, Isaiah would not have seen that. And I've had such reading like too many times, both growing up and then also now as an adult, that I feel like we need to put a pause on that, right? Uzziah was not Isaiah's enemy of progress. Nor is verse 1 talking about any kind of enemy of progress. It's just, you know, circumstantial information, contextual information, basically telling us that everything else we are about to read happened during the year that King Uzziah died. Nothing else. So just a pitfall for Bible study leaders and preachers out there who may be reading this otherwise.
I think that's brilliant. Instead of saying in 2010... they had to use some sort of big moment to let people know when it happened. And so that was just the circumstantial moment that was most easily referenced about when this thing happened. That's a great point.
That's right. Yeah.
Oh, Paul, this has just been a really rich conversation. Thanks for your great work on this call story and on how it might operate kind of in our lives and in our churches today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Well, friends, we hope that you've found something here to inspire your preaching and teaching this week. If you did, we would love it if you shared about this resource to friends and colleagues that you know. You can direct them to our website, firstreadingpodcast.com, and you can go there yourself and you can find back episodes. You can find ways to contribute if you would like to contribute either verbally in an email or financially in a subscription. We happily and gratefully accept both and all. Join us on Facebook if you'd like to give us a shout out there as well. And until next time, I'm Rachel Wren.
And I'm Paul Essa. Happy preaching.